Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And it appears that Republicans are in retreat over the controversial new House Ethics Committee rules. House Speaker Dennis Hastert said today that he is ready, perhaps as soon as today, to vote to scrap the rules. Mary Curtis is covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us from Washington. Mary, what's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the Republicans today had to take what is a very difficult step for a party politically, particularly a majority party. They had to basically acknowledge that they had made a mistake, that they had pushed through rules that the Democrats simply refused to accept, and that this had brought the ethics process in the House to a grinding halt, and that the only way to get it restarted again was to rescind those rules.
Now, remind us of what those rules were.
Well, there's three fairly obscure procedural rules, but the one that was really the stumbling block for the Democrats would have changed the rules that were in operation in the last Congress to require a majority of the Ethics Committee to agree to an investigation. Now, the Ethics Committee is the only committee in the House that is evenly divided between five Republicans and five Democrats, and the Democrats said that this would mean that it would be very difficult to launch an investigation because somebody would have to cross party lines.
And, of course, the Democrats felt that this was these rules were enacted specifically to prevent an investigation of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay.
Yes, or at least to make it much more difficult to raise the bar on any further investigation of Majority Leader DeLay.
Well, and is there a sense of where this change of heart today came from? Did it come from, say, the White House or from House Speaker Dennis Hastert?
Well, it came from members who were beginning to hear about this in their districts. There's been a lot of editorials written about this, a lot of editorial criticism of the paralyzing of the ethics process in the House. And I heard from members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, that they had begun to go to the Speaker and say, we need to do something about this. Now, it's true that some members, some Republicans, actually do not want to roll this back, think that it's a political humiliation for the Republicans, and they told Hastert that in a closed-door meeting today. He got some criticism from some of his members, but I'm told that ultimately they said, it's up to you, and we will support you whatever you decide to do.
Well, and as other members said, I'm reading a quote in an article that you've written online, you have to pivot, you have to eat some crow, you've got to get it behind you.
Yes, that was Congressman Ray LaHood, who said he spoke to Hastert personally and to Hastert's chief aides and said the best thing to do is take this hit and move on. What Republicans are hoping, of course, is that this is going to, in effect, lance the political boil for them and take away what has become a very potent political issue for Democrats. They think that, A, the Ethics Committee will no longer be an issue, and, B, you can move DeLay's problems into an ethics investigation, at which point, hopefully, they will fall off the front page headlines.
And perhaps give the Republicans the moral high ground to address issues like the filibuster and the selection of judges.
Yes, and you've hit a very good point. I mean, what LaHood and other congressmen were saying to me is they were telling the Speaker, this is becoming a distraction to the legislative agenda for Republicans. We want to get rid of this distraction.
So, Mary Curtis, what happens now? Is there a floor vote expected soon?
Yes, there is. It's not clear how soon. It is conceivable it could happen as early as today. But probably more likely that it would happen either late tonight or tomorrow. And that vote will probably consist of rescinding the rules.
And is it a vote of the, and who votes?
This would be the full House, because it was the full House that voted to make these rules changes on the opening day of the session in January. There were three rules embedded in a large package of rules changes.
Mary Curtis is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thirty years ago this week, the city of Saigon fell to the communist Viet Cong, and to the astonishment of the South Vietnamese population, pulverized by the first rockets to fall on the city in a decade. As one journalist wrote at the time, it seemed all of Saigon was running. Today, the streets of Saigon, now called Ho Chi Minh City, bustle with tourists. I visited the New Vietnam 3 years ago with the help of tour guide Cang Tran.
This is Vietnam.
We started in the north, at Halong Bay in the Gulf of Tonkin. It's called the Ho Chi Minh Trail on the water because Viet Cong once trafficked arms to the south through here, but now a delighted Cong took his first kayak trip.
Look up. Watch the rocks.
This is a postcard photo, huh?
Woo! Woo, woo, woo!
Cong took us to Buddhist temples for a ride on the back of a scooter through the buzzing streets of Hanoi, an unexpected cacophony to these Western ears.
Noise, yes, we were born with the noise.
What do you mean you were born with the noise?
Because you are a quiet American. We are noise Vietnamese. You'll remember the novel, Quiet American.
Right.
Yes.
And so the horns, honking the horns?
Yeah, to say, I'm here, I'm here.
We also visited Hue, where Cong had been attending university 30 years ago, when news of the Viet Cong push from the north came.
On March 1975, all the people in Hue fled to the south. And then I rode a bicycle to the south, to Da Nang. 9 a.m., I reached home at 11 p.m., and then people keep going for 7 days and night. 300,000 people.
What were you running from?
Because the city will be occupied by North Vietnam troops that they coming. Yeah. People just fleeing. So this is for you nothing but for me. Hue fell in March 26th, and then this city after the others, like a row of bottles. One fallen and hit the other, until the last one, Saigon. April 30th. That is at the end. So where is the beginning of the end?
Well, today we begin a two-part series looking back at the end of the war through the eyes of two people who were there. Tomorrow, a Marine sergeant who was the last to leave the roof of the American embassy after trying desperately to rescue as many South Vietnamese as possible. But today, we start with Cong Tran, one of the South Vietnamese left behind. We've called Cong at his home in Da Nang to ask his memories of the fall of Saigon. Cong, hello?
Hi.
Have you been thinking about it in Vietnam?
Yes, we are thinking in Vietnam, especially the people about my age. On my high school time, my university time is the Vietnam War. American troops came in 1965, so I was 11 years old. When the war ended, I was 21. So the climax of my life then. That's the time to remember.
What do you remember about the fall of Saigon?
The fall of Saigon, it is so fast. It is the panic. People say it took only 55 days to end the 10,000 days war. It was so fast. Really a panic for both sides.
A panic for your family.
We are the Dixie, not the Yankee. We are from the South. When American here, I ate a lot of chocolate, chewing gum, sea raisins from them.
You embraced the Americans, and in Vietnamese terms, you were Dixie, not Yankee, because you were from the South, right?
Yeah, I'm from the South. And at that time, we were a pump in our mind that we have to fight against the North to stop the communism coming, the red waves.
But now that red wave was washing over you. We've heard you were a student in Hue, and you rode your bike from Hue back to
my hometown in Da Nang.
To your family?
Yeah, in the U.S. Navy base in Da Nang.
Cong, you've written me that that was a tactical retreat on your part, but it became a tragic rout. What happened to you in Da Nang the day Saigon fell?
That day, I followed my classmate. I left my parents behind because they are old, and they don't want to go. So I went to the U.S. Naval base in Tien Sa and tried to get on the ship, but I missed the boat because one of my friends or my brother asked me to sit over there. But I was young then, so I walk around looking for the peach can.
Peach can?
Yeah, the peach can, the can of peach for the soldiers to eat. Peach can with the very nice juice in it, very sweet. So after that, a row of artillery shooting coming. And on the bay, the Navy may become panic. A lot of people get killed. And when I come back to the place, my friend of my brother asked me to sit there. He was not there. Yeah, I missed the boat. So, you see, I could not go to the state because of greedy. I want to eat peach. I lost my chance. Otherwise, now I worry in the States.
Oh, you're kidding. So you could not get out of Vietnam on the day that Saigon fell because you went to a naval base and wanted to get some peach juice.
Yeah, not because I'm hungry, but at that time, American can of food still like the mountain.
It was a big deal to have a peach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we have to confront with the new life. So people go back to their village to be a farmer. Yeah. So if you are the teachers, you are not sure you can get a position as a teacher. If you work with American size, you think they will put you in re-education camp. And no one dare to say he is wise. Because sometimes you are too fast, you die. You are too slow, you die. But you know how to control the speed, you survive.
But you knew many people who died.
Sure, on my high school classmate. Because I passed the exam to go to university, but my classmate went to the army. Mm. And at that time, they have to go to re-education camp, 6.5 years.
Were you able to go back to university?
Yes, I went back to university, but at that time, all my professors ran away. So I learned nothing. And then I smelled that they have a political discrimination against me, so I quit school. Right on that day, I feel I lose. Because when we saw the communists coming, we lost the war. We lost the South Vietnam. With the good education, with the economy like this, like that. But if you ask me, now I feel we gained reunification.
You gained reunification.
Right. So I can very happy to say that we have won Vietnam. That's what we gained.
Cong, what are people in Vietnam calling this day? You're saying it's a big celebration.
We call the Liberation Day of South Vietnam and reunification of our fatherland. Yeah, that is the official government slogan. People just say the day the war ended. That's it.
Cong Tran speaking to us from his home in Da Nang in Vietnam. When we come back, we'll ask Cong how he feels about the Americans who left. Stay with us. There's much more ahead here and now. On the line from Da Nang in Vietnam, Cong, now a much sought-after tour guide in Vietnam. But 30 years ago, he was, along with other South Vietnamese, desperately trying to escape the country after the fall of Saigon. Tomorrow, we're going to speak to a U.S. Marine who desperately tried to evacuate the South Vietnamese as the North closed in. But, Cong, there are several photos of that day 30 years ago. I'm thinking of one, an American punching a South Vietnamese, a former ally, in the face to try to keep him off a helicopter. What are your thoughts of the Americans who left you behind?
That photo, the man with the punch to the face, I saw that photo several times. The American guy just want to do his duty. That's it. I feel nothing.
Some Americans would say that's very forgiving.
Forgiving? You mean Vietnamese forgive American?
Yeah.
Yeah, because nothing. We don't feel anything. You come and then you go. and you want to tell us stay, not go. That's it.
You didn't feel abandoned by Americans that day?
Yes. Many people feel that way. I took one American coming back to the village where he fought.
Yeah, on a tour. You took him on a tour?
Yeah, and by chance he met a farmer. He is hoeing the rice fields. And when we stopped to talk, he was a surgeon for South Vietnam Army. And that American veteran asked me to translate to the man the same question you asked me. What do you feel about American? The Vietnamese farmer, who was the sergeant for South Vietnam, stopped the hoe. And then he said, if American had not come to Vietnam, my life should have been different, not working like a farmer like this. If American had stayed until the end, my life is different. But because American come and then left halfway, so my life like this. And then he hold the hoe, kept on working on the rice fields. Because the American, you help South Vietnam just with half hearted. One big mistake, that means you replace South Vietnam. That is like I carry a table. And then you say you are bigger. Let you carry. That is the reason I stopped carry the table. And then halfway you return the table to me. I cannot carry it at all. That's it.
So some people obviously do feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kong?
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Is there anything else that you want to say to people in America?
I just say, I wonder why they like to have a war. Like in Iraq now. So I think Iraq is another mistake, another Vietnam.
Kong Tran speaking to us from Da Nang. He tried to escape Vietnam 30 years ago this week, but missed a U.S. naval boat. He's now a tour guide in Vietnam. Kong, thank you.
You are welcome.
By the way, Kong, is your daughter still driving you crazy, listening to rock and roll?
Yeah, my daughter still. Maybe I will try to send her to Converse College in North Carolina.
Why?
She want to go there to study.
How do you feel about that?
It is okay. She will eat McDonald's, drink Coca-Cola.
But you last time we talked, you were upset about those Western influences.
It is okay. Her generation, she needs that. My generation, I don't need.
Yeah. Kong, do you think you'll ever come to America?
Yes.
Will they let you out?
Yeah. Now, if I have money, I can go out. If you give me the invitation letter, I can go out. And then number one priority, I come to Washington, D.C. To see the White House, to touch on the black marble.
The black marble of the Vietnam War Memorial.
Yeah. And to see some of my friends in Westminster, California. I still have many classmates there.
Well, the letter is in the mail. Kong, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Kong Tran, he spoke to us from his home in Da Nang, Vietnam. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the view from the roof of the U.S. Embassy as Saigon fell, a former Marine, one of the last 11 to leave and almost left behind.
We had confidence that, you know, they wouldn't leave us. But, you know, after about three and a half hours go by, you know, you start to have second thoughts. So it was discussed that what we would consider doing was the 11 Marines would climb down the rocket screen, and all of us trying to make it to the South China Sea, confiscating a vessel and making our own way out to the fleet. But off in the distance, probably about 30 minutes later, we could see a speck out there, and it was a helicopter. But we had to be careful because you had to realize that South Vietnamese that were defecting were also flying CH-46 helicopters. So we didn't know if it was a good guy or a bad guy. But as it, and we had no radio communication. By that time, our radios, the batteries were dead. But we had plenty of weapons on that roof. I mean, we had enough weapons to start a pretty good-sized firefight.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Healthcare experts call it disease management when experts coach patients with chronic or complex medical conditions. Patients who require complex care are just 10% of all patients, but their care is expensive. It accounts for 70% of all healthcare spending. Here now's Martha Biebinger reports on a program in Massachusetts that is trying to answer the question, can personal attention keep costs down?
Yeah, it's nuclear.
54-year-old Betty McIntosh sits at her kitchen table in Chelsea beneath a triptych of The Last Supper and a pro wrestling calendar. She's talking on the phone about nuclear cardiology.
My problem is I don't care about the task itself. I care about the machine that I'm going in, you know, because I get very...
This isn't an enclosed machine.
Oh, it's not enclosed?
No.
Oh, okay.
Health coach Maureen Allen, a registered nurse, is on the other end of the line in Manchester, New Hampshire. The two women talk for roughly 20 minutes about the stress test prescribed because McIntosh has been fainting and experiencing chest pains. They also cover arthritis trouble in McIntosh's shoulder, her low cholesterol diet, whether the cat is aggravating her asthma, and depression medications that are making McIntosh drowsy. Then Allen comes back to the test.
How are you feeling about this, Betty?
Nervous, but I guess I have to go through with it.
Yeah, it will give you a better idea of what's going on.
Right.
Allen calls McIntosh every 3 or 4 weeks, and McIntosh checks in when she has a problem, like an unexpected hospitalization last month.
Just that knowing that they're there, you know, that they're there to help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which they are there. They're very helpful.
McIntosh is in a 3-year pilot project for Medicaid patients run by Partners Healthcare. Boston-based Health Dialogue supplies the coaches. Partners is spending $1 million this year on the disease management program that includes coaches. Organizers expect to enroll more than 3,000 patients, like McIntosh, who have at least one of 5 common chronic physical diseases. Mental health problems are not included, although they are common among Medicaid recipients. Whether a coach works by phone or in person, the idea is to give patients more information about their condition so they'll take better care of themselves. Dr. Timothy Ferris supervises the project at Partners.
It's not simply knowing about your condition. It's also having the motivation and confidence to really get more at behavior change as a core value that's trying to be transmitted.
Ferris says coaching draws on strategies that have helped smokers and alcoholics quit to treat diseases like asthma, diabetes, or congestive heart failure, where a patient's lifestyle makes a difference. Coaches might ask a patient, on a scale of 1 to 10, how motivated are you to take better care of yourself? In any score above a 0, the coach looks for a reason. Maybe the patient acknowledges wanting to live longer or become a better parent.
There's something that's creating a 3 and not a 0. It might only be a thread of motivation, but it gives the coach something to build on.
Mary Jane Favaza supervises the roughly 400 nurses, respiratory therapists, and dietitians who handle calls for Health Dialogue.
And so they're looking for these opportunities to understand what are the kinds of things that will motivate and what are the seeds or the germs of motivation that they can help to build.
Usually, health coaches work through an insurance plan and have little contact with the patient's physician. At Partners, the coaches are communicating with the patient's doctor using email FYI notes.
sometimes those FYI notes are a little bit in the face of the doctor. I mean, we've had FYI notes that said, patient has trouble communicating with you.
Dr. Ferris says overall, the reaction from physicians is mixed.
We've had clinicians who've written back saying, this is great. I would say that's a small set. The large majority right now are somewhere in the middle camp of skeptical participants. And then there's a minority, again, who are vocally opposed to it.
Part of the skepticism is about how effective coaching can be in changing a patient's lifestyle. Most of the medical research has looked at disease management programs as a whole, not coaching specifically. An overview of the research from the Congressional Budget Office last fall concludes that there is not enough evidence to prove the strategy is cost-effective. Glenn Mays, Director of Research in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, says researchers are finding that with coaching, costs often go up initially because coaches find gaps in care.
Whether that's patients who are not taking the right prescriptions, not having them refilled, or not seeing their physicians on a regular basis for routine screening. So that is going to result in an you know, increase in service use in the short term and potentially higher costs in the short term.
May says the hope is that over the long term, better care will produce savings. And Melanie Bella at the Center for Healthcare Strategies in Princeton, New Jersey, says with healthcare costs rising, waiting for conclusive results is not always prudent.
Intuitively, we know the healthier the population is, you're not going to spend as much money. We've got to try something, and the best thing we have out there is the evidence that says, here's how care should be provided. These are the things that are going to make a difference in managing a person's condition, and trying them, and waiting, giving it enough time to see if the investment pays off.
Health Dialogue, which is working with partners, says coaches cut medical claims for a Western Pennsylvania Blue Cross plan by 1-3%, mostly by reducing hospital admissions. In Massachusetts, Tufts Health Plan, Harvard Pilgrim, and Blue Cross are all using health coaches in disease management programs, and some are actively marketing the strategy.
I have a plan to take control of my diabetes. Tufts Health Plan called me, and we came up with a program, a healthier diet and more exercise.
The phrase disease management flashes on the screen in soft blue letters as a middle-aged man threads a fishing line and talks about the diabetes treatment plan he has worked out with a nurse coach. Tufts claims to have saved $15 million in 1 year by helping patients manage their chronic conditions. Dr. Ferris at Partners says providing health coaches is part of a commitment to making sure everyone has health insurance.
If this works out, if this is successful, even at break even, this will allow a greater ability to fund a larger number of people because we're keeping the costs down on the most expensive segment.
Massachusetts Medicaid Director Beth Waldman applauds Partners for launching the program and says the state is watching it with interest, but with the federal government preparing to cut Medicaid spending, money for untested programs will be hard to find.
That report by Here Now's Martha Biebinger. And this note on another story we're following. The Algerian man known as the Millennium Bomber faces sentencing today, 4 years after he was convicted of taking bomb-making materials across the Canadian border with the intent of blowing up part of the L.A. airport. Prosecutors want Ahmed Ressam behind bars for 35 years. His lawyers say he's provided such valuable intelligence information about Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, for instance, or hints about 9/11 before it happened, that Ressam deserves no more than 12 years in prison. But Ressam is no longer cooperating with the people interrogating him. He's been held in solitary confinement undergoing intensive interrogations. And on that note, prosecutors say if Ressam doesn't cooperate, they may have to drop the case against two alleged accomplices in the Millennium Plot. Still to come, after your 15 minutes of fame, then what happens? Well, there's a new book to help you cope. You're listening to Here and Now. Should you be convicted of a crime if you claim you were asleep when it happened? Several juries around the country are considering cases where defendants say they're innocent of crimes ranging from sexual abuse to murder because they were sleepwalking. The latest case is unfolding in Lowell, Massachusetts today, where 33-year-old Richard Anderson is facing a pretrial hearing. He's accused of molesting two young girls, and he claims he suffers from sexsomnia, a disorder where a person has sex while asleep but has no memory of it happening. In another case in New Jersey, Jonathan Hutchinson was charged with molesting his girlfriend's daughter. He claimed he was sleepwalking, and the jury recently deadlocked. Joining us on the line is Aaron Dalton of Legal Affairs Magazine. He's been covering these cases. Aaron, in the Hutchinson case, what did he say happened?
What Jonathan Hutchinson said was that he never realized what he was doing until he woke up. And when he woke up, then he was very confused. He realized he was in the wrong place, and he immediately left the room, went back to his own room, kind of tried to figure out what had been going on. And then he said, went back to sleep.
Well, and so what happens now? Is he back in that same home while the jury is deadlocked? Will the state retry him?
From what I understand, they're scheduled to retry him in July. He's not back in the home because he's not with his girlfriend anymore. Obviously, she realized that this was not a tenable situation for her or her children. Yeah. But he is free on his own reconnaissance.
How often is this sleepwalking defense used, and has anyone been cleared using it?
Well, there's certainly been other cases where people were cleared using it. There have been 20 to 30 cases, you know, in recent years. The defense actually goes all the way back in the United States to 1846, when a man named Albert Terrell successfully used the sleepwalking defense to win acquittal after he murdered his mistress, who was a prostitute in Boston, actually, and then burned down her brothel. It's been used in other more recent times. In 2001, there was a young man who was charged with burglary and sexual assault from walking into at least 10 dorm rooms at UMass Amherst. He said he was sleepwalking while he'd done this, and the jury deliberated for less than an hour before acquitting him.
Well, and we understand there was also a case in Canada where a man got in a car, drove several miles, bludgeoned to death his mother-in-law, and claimed he was sleepwalking.
It's true, and it seems unbelievable. The jury acquitted him and believed that, yes, he had drove 14 miles to the home of his in-laws, killed his mother-in-law, nearly killed his father-in-law, drove home, and then woke up, called the police, said he thought maybe that he'd killed some people, and they believed him, and they did acquit him.
In the Lowell, Massachusetts case, Richard Anderson is accused of molesting two girls. He claims he suffers from sexsomnia, a disorder where a person engages in sex while sleeping. Is that a recognized syndrome?
As far as I know, yes. There are sleep experts who say sexsomnia does exist, or sleep sex is actually the way that I've heard it referred to. The interesting thing about it, though, as I understand it, is that it usually happens between two people who share the same bed. It's very rare, as I understand it, that somebody would actually get up, walk into a different room while sleepwalking, and engage in some sort of sexual activity.
How does the legal world view this?
Well, I think there are some people who are very worried that this could become a more common defense. They're saying this could be the next Twinkie defense. And if people remember, back in 1978, there was a man named Dan White who his lawyers used the defense that he was suffering from diminished capacity, which was a defense in California at the time. They said that he was addicted to junk food and that the sugar that he had ingested from eating Twinkies had worsened his depression and led him to murder Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk. And, you know, they're worried that people are going to just use the sleepwalking defense to say they're not responsible for their actions.
On the other hand, if it's true, if this is something that really is happening to people, causing them to do these terrible things, what a terrible thing for them.
It's absolutely a terrible thing for them. And, you know, obviously there are some juries who believe that it is a possibility. Sleep experts seem very divided on this. And I think, you know, I guess as more light is shown on this, hopefully more research will be done and it'll become clearer what people really can or can't do in their sleep. We have to remember, I think, that sleep science is a very young science, and in fact, the first sleep research center at Stanford University was only established in 1970.
Aaron Dalton is a writer for Legal Affairs Magazine. He's been speaking to us about the use of the sleepwalking defense. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Yeah.
It was, of course, Andy Warhol who said, in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. And if Andy were around today, he could point to TV shows like American Idol, Fear Factor, and The Bachelor and say, see? But what happens in that 16th minute when the press, the public, and the hangers-on move on? The new book, The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame, attempts to answer that question. The book is co-written by Douglas Perry and Jeff Gwynn, both newspaper editors, Douglas at The Oregonian and Jeff at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And Jeff joins us from the studios of NPR member station KERA in Fort Worth, Texas. Hello.
Hi.
Well, your book prompted a lot of, oh yeah, I remember her remarks today. And I'm wondering, is that how it started? You know, perhaps the two of you sitting around and saying, whatever happened to...
Well, it's almost right. A number of years ago, I'm the books editor at the Star-Telegram, and I got a call from a publicist saying Monica Lewinsky had a ghostwritten memoir, and did I want to interview Monica about her life? And I thought to myself, I'd really like to talk to her in about 10 years, when she's realized that fame was going to be very quick for her and she had to go back and rebuild her life. And once I thought about that, then I began thinking of who people might be right now that sort of fit that pattern.
Yeah. And you and your co-author, again, Douglas Perry, profile seven such people in the book. Could you just give us the overarching thought about each of them?
Certainly. What we wanted to do was find people who had become famous in different areas and also people who would be considered coming from a normal background that had to work to achieve what they did. So we had a couple athletes, Maury Wills from the Los Angeles Dodgers, who set all kinds of stolen base records, Jerry Cooney, the former heavyweight boxer.
Boxing's last great white hope, it said.
He was that, and he had a lot of hopes. They were destroyed, and yet he rebuilt his life in a memorable way. Irene Cara from the world of music, Jim Wright from politics, Susan McDougall, who certainly didn't intend to become a national figure, but did.
We're reminded Susan McDougall, the friend of Bill Clinton's, the woman who refused to testify before Kenneth Starr's Whitewater investigation and went to jail.
Right. Susan McDougall, who never intended to become famous. Mick Foley, the professional wrestler known as Mankind, who wants to become one of America's great literary figures. And perhaps the first modern-day celebrity, Melvin Dumar, who just for a little while became one of the most famous people in America and just as quickly dropped back into obscurity and has never recovered since.
Well, let's start with Melvin Dumar. Remind us of his story and his relationship with, or his alleged encounter with, Howard Hughes.
Well, just about the time in the middle 60s that for the first time the majority of Americans had TV sets at home, and about the time Warhol was talking about instant celebrity, there was a milkman named Melvin Dumar who desperately, desperately wanted to become a famous country singer. In fact, he had very little talent, and he was one of those decent-natured schlubs that we all know. One night he was driving across the Nevada desert, and as he was driving through the desert, he saw an emaciated old man lying by the side of the road. He's a nice man, is Mr. Dumar, and he stopped to pick him up, said he'd take him to a hospital. The old man said he wanted to go to Las Vegas, and his name was Howard Hughes. Well, Melvin didn't know that he believed that, but he sang Howard some songs he'd written, drove him, dropped him off. Forgot about it until a couple years later, when suddenly there was at least one copy of an alleged will by Hughes that was leaving Melvin 1/16th of his personal fortune. The media jumped all over it. For the first time, television brought this kind of thing right into people's homes. And Melvin temporarily became quite famous.
Jeff Gwynn, what do we know about that story, though? Did he really meet Howard Hughes? Is there a chance that Howard Hughes would have put Melvin Dumar in his will?
You see, that's the thing about it. The possibility is what's so intriguing to the onlookers. And as we do, any time we make someone even temporarily a celebrity, people sort of put their own spin on what they wanted. We have this idea that fame is controlled by the famous people. That's not true at all. It's really controlled by the public, who decide how long someone's interesting and then forget about him or her. In Melvin's case, we came away convinced he believes it. Now, at the same time, the courts ruled that the will was a forgery and that someone had to be behind a plot. Well, we've met Melvin, we've sat around, we've talked with him. And I have to say, I don't know that he has the imagination to come up with something like that, because whoever did it was pretty darn clever if it was, in fact, a hoax.
What did he and his family say about that brief moment of fame?
Melvin now drives a meat truck in Utah. His wife says she wishes he had never met that crazy old man and there hadn't been anything about the will. But for Melvin, that was the opportunity just briefly to taste the fame he wanted. Now, the things that happened as a result, being vilified later in the media, being scorned, in a sense, that's a price he's willing to pay for that wonderful moment when people would recognize him on the street and ask for an autograph. Hmm. It's always a trade-off. Fame will cost anyone who has it.
Ask Irene Cara. Is it possible that, as you write, she only got about, what, $183 in royalties? She won an Academy Award for writing
What a Feeling.
What a Feeling. And then claims that she, just because she signed some contracts in the wrong way, she was misrepresented, that she didn't get a penny or hardly a penny for any of her work and was blacklisted.
The problem for Irene was she challenged the record industry and her manager at a time when pop stars were considered interchangeable, as they still are today. It didn't occur to her that if she offended the powers that be in the music industry, they'd simply drop her and come up with some other young woman who might not be equally talented but was equally marketable. And the fact does remain that there's no doubt one of the most talented young women in the music industry has spent 20 years in obscurity ever since her greatest successes. Why did that happen? In part because of the celebrity machine. The minute the studios and the album people weren't pushing her, then the fans went on to the next diva.
You know, I'm looking at some of the names. Jim Wright, the congressman from Texas. We talked about Irene Cara, Maury Wills, the shortstop. And we're talking about 15 minutes of fame. I'm thinking, wow, those people seem, their experiences seem so rich and deep compared to the fleeting fame of today. It's sort of been reduced to 15 seconds of fame.
Well, that's the point. Now with television, with the internet, which has made a tremendous difference, there's more opportunities for people to become temporarily well-known and often for very humiliating things. Any of us who've watched even a few of these reality TV shows are getting a sense that now people want to be famous. A generation ago, you wanted to be famous for accomplishing something. But it seems that now, particularly for young people who've been brought up during this era, fame itself is the object. It doesn't matter what you get famous for, just so long as people know your name. And I think that's a very sad thing.
Jeff Kuhn, before we let you go, just one last thought about, you know, someone who I really do enjoy, Irene Cara, and I'm hoping that you came up with the conclusion that maybe we'll hear from her again. What do you think?
Her talent is still exceptional. As long as she's trying, as long as she has those gifts, things could happen for her again. And if they do, a lot of us are going to hear some wonderful music.
Jeff Kuhn, co-author of the book, The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The name is Irene Cara. You remember, Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.